Hello, and welcome to another episode of LGM Talks. I'm Nick Jardine, and I'm the content manager for the private markets business at L&G. Recently, we reviewed our 2025 private markets outlook on the podcast, focusing on some key specific sectors. Today, we're shifting our focus to a broader horizon, exploring the megatrends that will shape private markets well into the future. I'm delighted to welcome Bill Hughes, L&G's Global Head of Private Markets, and Rob Martin, Global Head of Investment Strategy and Research, to the podcast today. Thanks to you both for being here.
Hi.
Bill, this is a particularly exciting moment for our private markets division. Perhaps a good way to start is for you to lay out what's changed recently and kind of what the goals for the business are.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Of course. It really is an exciting time. What we're doing is we're bringing together the real assets part of LGIM and together with Legal and General Capital. The point of that is that there are some real strengths in both of those businesses, but even more so the case as you bring those two businesses together. We've got an opportunity to really think through what works for client capital. We're definitely going to be about amplifying the things that we do well. We are selectively thinking about what can we bring to the business where there may be gaps that are important. So we're thinking that through as well. And alongside all of that, we continue to innovate and strive for excellence in terms of how we think about the capital we're here to serve. So, it is really exciting. As we go into 2025, I'm delighted by where we've got to so far, and we're capable of building a real powerhouse in private markets.
Of course, one big change for you is that you've got a new boss.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, Eric Hadler. He arrived in the building at the beginning of December. Actually, as it happens, the day I took over responsibility for the global private markets business. And that's actually proven to be a really important moment in a number of ways that not everyone's thinking about. First of all, he's come to the business with a totally fresh perspective. And of course, the advantage of that is he's got no legacy, no involvement with what's gone on in the past. He's looking at it in terms of where do we go from here. And I think that's really, really valuable and really useful. And the second perhaps defining feature about Eric compared to many of the people that have gone before, he really is an investor by background. So he thinks about the quality of our investments, and that will serve us well in terms of investment, but also about how we deploy investments within our business in terms of people and capital and choices we're making. The third thing is, Nick, you'll know he's from the US and has worked in a business that was global. So I think our aspirations in terms of continuing our journey towards globalization have been, to some extent, ramped up a little by Eric arriving. But he's a good guy. I'm having fun with him. Very direct, which works for me. And long may that last. I'm looking forward to working with Eric.
I think it's probably worth noting that Eric actually had a role previously quite similar to yours. And people might not know this, but you used to have Rob's role. So I guess, Rob, a question for you, kind of given that you've been kind of where Bill is now, is, I guess, do you have any advice for him? How is it for you?
That's a bit punchy, isn't it? I mean, this could be a bit career limiting. Let's start with the advantage. Fundamentally, your boss understands what you do. That is a great place to start from. I think one of the things we've certainly worked on over the years is getting a good understanding of what each other does, what they want to do, how they're going to spend their time. You know, it's very tempting for someone with a background in what you do to want to be involved. No one wants to be micromanaged. But actually, I think the advantage is if you get it right, you both really enrich each other's thinking. Bill and I have worked together for nearly 20 years, so we found a way of making it work.
Let's get on to private markets. Rob, from an investment strategy perspective, let's start with an easy one. What are you thinking about the implications of the new US administration?
Brilliant. Thanks, Nick. All right. Yeah. Easy peasy.
Okay. Question.
So I think one of the things, you know, we've talked about as a wider business very early on is there is a real need to separate signal from noise in this environment. So what I mean by that is there will be an awful lot of noise. And we mustn't be whipsawed by that. We must really sort of focus on things which are fundamental, things which are actually happening rather than speculation. Obviously, there's a huge amount in you know, the new administration's sort of portfolio of things that it's thinking about, focusing probably on three areas that are especially important for us in private markets. I think there's clean energy, there's the world of M&A, and then there's the overall balance of tax and spend. When it comes to clean energy, the new administration has been quite vocal in having some views on the Inflation Reduction Act and the energy transition in the US. We should not pretend that this is going to be a wholesale reversal, because I don't think that's what's going to happen. The economics of clean energy are increasingly persuasive, but it does imply there's going to be less public policy support, both through subsidies and through regulation, for new clean energy projects in the US. And that's particularly around EVs, around battery storage, and also the offshore wind sector. So I think there is no doubt there is a risk premium around those sectors at the moment. On the flip side, M&A is particularly important for private equity. There is, it's still going to be, and I think people should not overstate how laissez-faire this is going to be. There are still going to be concerns over national security and job implications from mergers and acquisitions. But I think it's very clear that the new administration is going to take a different approach, a less interventionist approach when it comes to M&A. That is quite helpful for many private equity businesses. It makes it easier to sell businesses because your buyer is less likely to encounter regulatory opposition. But equally, a big part of how PE grows value is by merging and actually scaling businesses. So actually, it's easier to buy. So I think we're probably going to see more acquisition activity in PE. Then the third thing I would talk about is inflation. The overall balance of tax and spend is likely to boost GDP. Some of the trade policies, which we would see as a wider part of deglobalization, are potentially inflationary as well. In fact, I think they're definitely inflationary personally if they are executed as described. So I think a lot of investors are going to be thinking carefully about inflation and inflation risk. And for us, that really sort of reinforces a positioning that we've had for quite a long time. I would say short-dated credit, which benefits from higher interest rates, that looks quite an interesting place to be. In the longer-dated credit space, we look at credits which are particularly good at having pricing power. And then on the asset side, within real estate, we look at residential as being a sector that has historically performed as quite a good hedge against inflation. So we think that's increasingly important from a portfolio management perspective in this next phase.
So on the subject of geopolitics, one of the megatrends we see influencing private markets is deglobalization. It's not the only megatrend we see influencing private markets. I was wondering if you could just remind our audience what these megatrends are.
Yeah, that's right, Nick. It's an area we've spent a lot of time thinking about over the last, probably 3 years in particular. So as you say, deglobalization, the first of the four Ds. We also articulate demographics, not new, almost by definition, but still really important. Decarbonisation, hugely important, both in terms of driving asset creation, but also how we think about managing assets to try and reduce energy consumption. And then digitalisation. There's clearly a huge build out in digital infrastructure, but also the impact of new technologies and how they're influencing the industries that we finance and invest in, that we really need to take account of in how we invest.
So, Bill, one of the reasons I wanted today to be kind of taking a long-term view is because we often kind of talk about patient capital when we talk about private markets. Yeah. And perhaps we could talk a little bit about how having that long-term approach kind of gives investors opportunities.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And first of all, I want to hark back to Rob's question you put to him about the Trump administration, right? Because patient capital can look through the political cycle, and after Trump there's going to be another president, and after that there'll be another one. So the time frame within which we operate within private markets, I think, is both a feature and a real advantage if you know how to use that to your benefit. Typically in private markets, we're talking about assets that not just with mostly with long time frames, not always, mostly with long time frames. And in a sense, you're getting your arms around and deliberately benefiting from the illiquidity that comes with that. By the way, quite often we feel that you get an illiquidity premium. But this thing about patient capital, in a sense, gives you the opportunity to be very long-sighted about the benefits of an investment. You don't have to worry necessarily about the immediate first year or two. There is an opportunity for things to come to fully to fruition. And when you think about things like regeneration, for example, which is both complicated and often frustrated by the system that it's in, you do need a long time frame within which to get stuff done. Without that long time frame, without that patient capital approach, you're going to be very limited about what you can do. And our goal is to ensure in private market investment decision making, we do things that are truly relevant to society. And I think with patient capital, you've got a reasonable chance of doing that. If you're prophetic, you act with care and attention, you think about the impact of what you're doing upon the individual people that use the built environment, because it's across the totality, through all sorts of, through debt, equity, venture capital, infra equity, all of those things. There's lots of good examples in our portfolio where if we had a short time frame and if we were not patient, we'd be stuck. Good example, we talk about it a lot. There's a shopping centre down in Poole on the south coast of the UK and some units next to it called Kingland. And what we did there is structure things in such a way as to make things relatively favourable for a number of years for some new tenants that were all selected. These businesses were selected locally. So it's about community, it's about local. But we gave them some breathing space, because we're patient, to allow them to get to a break even, to allow them to start to flourish, to allow those businesses to grow. And that's a really interesting example of, with patient capital, you can curate some success. Without it, you can't.
That's, a fantastically comprehensive answer. I feel almost like I'm going to kind of contradict myself with the next question, because it's about a more kind of recent event. Obviously, at the time that we're recording this, we've seen a little bit of, that's probably an understatement, we've seen some volatility in government bond yields. Rob, I'm just wondering from your standpoint, how do you see this kind of affecting the private market space?
Yeah, I mean, but bond yields, the way a lot of private market investors think about their cost of capital, they will often reference bond yields as a sort of a risk-free rate, and they're looking for a premium over and above that. Bill mentioned it, the illiquidity premium. So when you see volatility in bond yields, often people will see that as challenging for private markets and increasing the cost of capital, increasing the required return. And that was definitely true in 2022. We saw a big run-up in bond yields in 2022, and we saw equity prices sell off. We saw what was the dreaded denominator effect. And what that means is, private market valuations move more slowly than the public market. So what happened is the public market sold off very aggressively, and many asset owners were left with outsized positions in the private markets. They were above target relative to where they wanted to be. And therefore, the following couple of years, we've seen a lot of investors trim back on their fresh capital going into the asset class. Situation's a bit different now, because whilst bond yields have gone up a lot, equity prices have been strong as well. So actually, if you're a multi-asset investor, over the course of 2024, you saw fantastic performance in your portfolio. Most investors will have about 80% of their assets in equity. So actually, the position is a little bit different. That denominator effect, if anything, is now for many asset owners going to be pointing that they're closer to target or maybe even below target in terms of their allocations to private markets. So I think we get a slightly different result, which is actually we got more investors looking at the private markets this year. What I would say, though, is that there is still, justifiably and rightly, a need for a really targeted approach. There are certainly parts of the market that have sold off more than others. We think there's a particular valuation case around real estate, particularly in the UK and the US. It's not the same everywhere else. So whilst the overall environment is more constructive, it's still one in which you really need to pick the hot spots.
It's interesting that you kind of talk about more investors looking at private markets now, because I think that relates to my next question, which is for you, Bill, which is there has been some focus kind of recently on kind of widening or kind of, dare I say, democratizing the kind of the access to private markets. I'm just wondering, what are your overall thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think it's really important to position this because there is an enormous amount of capital in any country that would want to be able to invest in private markets. And I think accessibility for private markets is an issue that's resided because of illiquidity, because of complexity, sometimes because of the products that are allowed and regulation. We've worked really hard at L&G to find a way to allow defined contribution pension funds in particular, which does cover an increasing body of the pension fund system in the UK, to allow DC money to invest in private markets. Because we manage a lot of capital, both in public and private space, what we can do effectively is position illiquid private markets within a wider pool where we can blend liquidity, where we can blend cost and provide a really attractive solution, including private markets, for a much wider array of investors. And we're delighted with progress so far. And you know, this is partly about doing the right thing for the UK pension fund body, where we're looking to provide a good investment outcome, and accessibility is what we've done there.
Great. I mean, this is, I guess, kind of a related question, but I'd be kind of interested to hear if you're hearing anything from clients at the moment that you think just might be kind of worth flagging for our audience.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, I'm on the road quite a lot around the world, and there's a number of things, and you know, Rob and I will see things through different functions in our organization. But a couple of things I'd emphasize. There certainly are investors out there, clients out there, who are thinking about this being an interesting moment in time from a timing entry point of view. There is a quite material parts of the private markets that have been marked to market that represents, therefore, post-repricing, quite an interesting entry point. So there is some short-termism, having said what I said about long-term, there is some short-termism about the timing. So, for example, I'd say US real estate looks like a good vintage. If you enter US real estate now, the feeling is that will look like a good general entry point for that particular asset class. And it's true in pockets of private credit as well. And there are some really interesting opportunities based on that. But the other thing I hear from clients a lot, harking back to Rob's comment about his 4Ds, I do hear more and more talk of what I would call the themes that matter, the long-term trends. Not everyone necessarily talks about the 4Ds, but those things are very recognisable. I hear a lot about decarbonisation being important in terms of asset selection, investment selection, manager selection. I hear a lot about digitalization as being one of the really important investment opportunities right now, because there's a big funding gap there. By the way, in decarbonization, there's also a huge funding gap. There's a really interesting opportunity mismatch between supply and demand. Always looks attractive to investors. So they're the sorts of things on the mind of private markets investors as I go around the world. More optimism now than was the case 12 months ago, partly born of pricing, partly born of the fact that investing and funds actually taking action has been going sideways for the past year or 18 months. And now there's a very, very interesting opportunity across most of the asset classes that we represent in private credit, in real estate equity, infrastructure equity, and in venture capital. So it's going to be an interesting year.
I like the fact that you were kind of talking about more optimism there, because we kind of aim for the podcast to be both informational and inspirational. I want to end on an optimistic note. So I was going to ask both of you, just kind of with private markets in mind, what's one thing in the future, let's say over the next 12 months, that you're kind of looking forward to?
Who's going first?
Rob.
Look, I'll give it a stab. I mean, I think one of this is not new and it's not the next 12 months, but one of the things I think is probably different to what I might have said 10 years ago, and let's show my age a little bit. If we think about those themes we're talking about, you know, digitalization, demographics, decarbonization, those all kind of connect to social outcomes. And one of the things that I feel really enthused about is the degree to which we can deliver investment performance for clients, but also guide our capital, invest in such a way so that it also has a wider economic and social benefit. That's not new, but I do think that's a really core part of who we are, who many people are, and that I find very exciting.
Similar point for me, really, Nick. I think LNG's been for many years now, I want to say 15, looking to be very purposeful about how it invests in private markets. And that's about creating and investing in assets that are relevant to society, that are seen by a political regime as being useful. As we roll forward, these themes that we talk about and the way that we invest in those themes become more and more appealing and more recognised for what they're doing. And so we're spending a lot of time talking to clients about these issues. Our clients are generally excited and supportive of what we're doing there. We talk to government. Government is supportive and excited about trying to help us do more of what we're doing. So that's the world we're moving into. And I can tell you, I'm delighted that the company that Rob and I are in, that you're in, has been thinking about these things now for some time. So we have a really great platform from which to move forward.
Excellent. Well, Rob, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks. Thank you.